Chapter 5. Refugees. Standing on his hind legs, Stripe, a 250-pound moon bear with yellowish eyes, is looking Gary in the face through the partially closed window of the Jeep's passenger seat. A window that Gary discovers with some dismay is not easily rolled up. Meanwhile, another bear, having chewed for some time on one of our tires, is attempting to remove the hubcap of a rear wheel with its claws. "No, no, no," chides Johan Lindzo, the Swedish veterinarian in the driver's seat. Speaking very gently and slowly, as if to a small child, he tells the enormous beast, "No, no, you're destroying the car." Inside our parked vehicle, we are adrift among a sea of bears. Besides the two who are chewing and probing the Jeep, there are another 5 moon bears within 20 feet of us, and perhaps another 10 within sight. Some lounge in shallow pools. Sitting upright with arms spread out, they look like fat old men in the whirlpool bath at a health club. A few relax beneath trees, leaning their backs against the trunks, their stumpy limbs akimbo, showing the smooth, moist soles of their feet. Some stand, watching us with benign, almost avuncular interest, while others lunch on rice mixed with dog biscuits, just delivered, still steaming, by the workers manning the green food truck in front of us. I've never been to a Club Med, but this is what I imagine it might look like, if all the guests were big, fat, black, and hairy. But this is no resort, nor is it a zoo. For these animals, as well as another 45 moon bears and 14 sun bears, 50 macaques, 30 gibbons, 10 crocodiles, 4 binturongs, and 200 dogs, Thailand's Banglamung Wildlife Breeding Center is essentially a well-appointed refugee center. Gary and I had learned about Banglamung shortly before we left the United States for Cambodia. Located just outside the popular Thai resort city of Pattaya, 140 kilometers southeast of Bangkok, the center hosts some 60 moon bears, surely one of the largest concentrations of moon bears in the world. It would be a good place, we figured, to check for golden bears on our way back from our travels with Sun Hyun. Despite the name of the facility, none of the animals were bred here, Johan explains. Except for the dogs, strays who were dropped off at a nearby temple, all of these animals were once wild, captured by poachers, and then confiscated by the Thai Royal Forest Department. These bears are like war refugees, but they are refugees from the illegal trade in wild animals, the war on Asia's wilderness. Some were once pets. Many had been destined for the dinner plate or the pharmacy. A few years ago, 18 bears came in one load from a restaurant, Johan tells us, shaking his blonde head. The soft-spoken veterinarian removes his wire-rimmed glasses and pinches the spot above the bridge of his nose, as if the memory physically hurts him to recall. Although far fewer bears are coming into the facility these days, Johan says, in the years after Thailand declared the trade illegal in 1992 and actually began to enforce the law, it was hard to keep up with the flow of animals. 2 years ago, a bear even came to them via a Bangkok brothel. When a man had stopped at this massage parlor for directions, its staff couldn't help but notice the female moon bear cub in his pickup. They asked what he was going to do with her. He was going to sell her to a Korean restaurant. At this, the ladies were so distressed that they pooled their money and bought the bear for 20,000 baht, the equivalent of over $500, and then turned her over to the Forest Department. When she arrived at Banglamung, the volunteers named her Harem in honor of her saviors. Banglamung wasn't originally set up to accommodate bears at all. When it opened 2 decades before, the place was, as its name implies, part of a network of wildlife breeding centers run by the Thai Royal Forest Department for native pheasants, monkeys, and deer. Their progeny, it was hoped, would restock Thailand's overhunted forests. But when confiscated animals started pouring in, needing a place to live, a private charity stepped in to help. The Thai Society for the Conservation of Wild Animals, TSCWA, founded in 1996 by an expat Australian and 2 Thai, procured the funding to build spacious cages and outdoor pens, and amassed volunteers to help care for the animals. The World Society for the Protection of Animals donated $60,000 for the 10-acre bear enclosure and then provided money for another 35,000-square-foot pen for 9 more moon bears. Johan, who leaves his lucrative practice in Malmö, Sweden, for 3 months each year to volunteer at Banglemung, personally raised much of the funding for another large outdoor enclosure to house an additional 20 confiscated moon bears, who'll be transferred from another facility when this one is built. Considering they spent most of their life in a small cage before they came here, or their mothers were killed in the forest, it's so much, much better here, Johan says, surveying the scene before us. Giant black moon bears are everywhere, free to loll and snuff in peace and comfort. Some dig and sniff in holes in the earth, some paw at coconut husks, several more step from behind bushes to stare dimly at our car with mahogany eyes and quest after our scent with wet, pink-lined nostrils. One bear is enjoying a good scratch. With half-closed eyes, he leans back against a tree trunk. The scrape of his great claws against the itch on his belly sounds as delicious as biting into a juicy papaya. "I've never seen so many moon bears in my life," Gary exclaims with delight. "And frankly, I've never seen such large moon bears. Some of them are surely more than 200 kilograms. These are very impressive animals, just wonderful." Another bear, with a huge, thick mane and a wide, white V on the chest, approaches the jeep, rises on 2 feet, and peers at us through the windshield. The other bear continues to paw at our hubcap. "No, no," Johan repeats gently. "I wouldn't say he would destroy the car just to have a go at us," he says to reassure us. "He just wants to chew everything and examine everything." "He's taking off the hubcap," I announce from the back of the sauna-hot jeep. "Can he puncture the tire with his claws?" Johan casts another glance behind us. "Oops. Yes, I see this," he says. "Okay, I think we have to leave now." He starts up the engine, and we move on to survey another group of bears. Bears with pointy faces, bears with huge bushy manes, bears with almost no manes at all, bears with stumpy legs, bears with long black fur, bears with woolly undercoats. We saw muddy bears, dusty bears, wet bears, pudgy bears, fat bears, and some weighing over 400 pounds, really, really fat bears, one of whom we later discovered was named Lardy. Timid bears peered at us cautiously from behind the protection of trees. Occasionally, we saw quarrelsome bears. When bears argue, they stand on their hind feet with hunched postures, make hideous wrinkled faces at one another, showing their huge yellow teeth and snarling. Although we were baking in the jeep, it was lovely to be in their presence. The sorrow was that all these bears should have been wild. For everyone rescued, probably dozens, if not hundreds more, had been killed, murdered so their cubs could be stolen, or butchered for delicacies or elixirs for which substitutes were cheaply available. Gary scrutinized each bear with the exacting eye of a taxonomist. Several years ago, he was in charge of cataloging the Field Museum's collection of 40,000 mammal fossils, a job that sometimes demanded he be able to classify species on the basis of the cusp shape of a single tooth. "Now, the nose of that bear looks slightly undercut, like the bear we saw at Prey Ving," he would say to me, a feature that even with binoculars I couldn't detect. "This bear's forehead seems slightly less sloping than the others," he would note. And then, "the rear claws on this bear seem to have an ivory tinge." But of course, the feature of greatest interest was coat color. "There's a greater range of coloration in these bears than what I anticipated," he told Johan and me. "These bears range all the way from coal black to black with brownish tinges to bears with blondish hairs on different parts of the body to bears that seem to have black hairs that are almost silver-tipped or perhaps blonde-tipped." We saw a number of bears with unusual pale markings. One of them was Stripe, who'd been trying to get into Gary's window. Stripe is also called Farang, a rather impolite Thai word for foreigner. He had acquired both names because of the light fur on his face. Parts of his legs and back were blondish too, and his claws were ivory. Like our Cambodian golden bears, his eyes were ringed in black, and the black mane framing the distinctive face made him especially handsome. We also met a similarly colored bear called Lewis, with a notch in his left ear. He, too, sported large black eye rings set against a pale face, as well as pale inner ears, front legs, and hind paws. These animals seemed a sort of intermediate between golden bears we'd seen in Cambodia and the black moon bears that were commonly known. This gradation, from black bears to blonde ones, was a disappointment for Gary. "I don't think we're dealing with a new species," he said with a sigh. Gary was disappointed, but not dejected. "We could still have a subspecies if the paler bears are all concentrated in a geographic area," he pointed out. The criteria for naming a new subspecies, set forth along with those for new species in the International Code of Zoological Nomenclature, boil down to two basic requirements. To qualify as a subspecies, its members must not interbreed with another population. Usually, this is because the populations are separated by a geographic barrier, like a river or mountain range. And the majority, 75%, according to the great taxonomist Ernest Mayr, of the adult specimens must be physically distinguishable from those in other populations by at least one measurable physical characteristic. When the code was first adopted in 1901, the characteristics separating subspecies were visually identifiable. Features like color, the shape of the bone of the skull, general size. But in subsequent revisions, which are issued every few years by the International Congresses of Zoology, London, the code increasingly recognizes genetic differences as physical characteristics. Not all the bears in one population would have to be golden or even light-faced to constitute a new subspecies. Depending on what the lab work showed, Gary still might be able to name a new subspecies. He already had a name in mind, one that would honor his parents, Don and Ruth. Ursus tibetanus donruthi. We saw no golden bears, but then we could not see all the bears in the main enclosure. Some had climbed into trees. Others were resting in the shade of concrete dens. Still others were hidden in the grass. And there were yet more bears to see elsewhere. After our drive with Johann, as gibbons whooped and dogs barked, we walked around the 190-acre compound, peering over fences and into cages, searching, like shoppers in a mall full of clothing stores, for coats that caught our eye. One of them was Romeo's. A sizable subadult male, he had a pallid, grizzled face, light front legs, and black rings around the eyes. Romeo proved to be Gary's favorite bear. Romeo clearly liked Gary, too. In fact, it seemed the professor and the bear were engaged in a perfectly cogent conversation. "I'd like you to show me your chest," Gary would announce to the bear. "Would you do that?" Almost immediately, Romeo rose to his hind legs, placed his paws on the green bars of the cage, displayed to Gary a narrow, V-shaped white chest mark, and held the pose for several photographs. "Every bear I've looked at in Southeast Asia seems to have a white chin," Gary then noted. "Is your chin white?" Romeo then tilted his head up. "Yes," said the professor, recording this on his memo pad. "Yes, it is." "Now I would like to see your belly," Gary said. Romeo rolled over. "Are you the bear whisperer?" I asked, only half joking. "No, but if you were asking him to pose and show every part of his anatomy bit by bit, we could hardly do better," the professor replied matter-of-factly. We both knew that Romeo, if he understood human language, probably knew Thai, not English. But it was possible that this very active and alert animal may have been reading Gary's subtle, inadvertent posture or scent cues to determine that he had struck a pose that pleased his visitor. Whether or not he was a genius, Romeo was certainly a very friendly bear. So was Samsri, the large black female who shared his spacious cement-floored enclosure and its piles of tree trunks for climbing. Both allowed us to scratch the backs of their tall, round ears and touch their wet noses through the bars of the cage. When we mentioned we would like to pull hairs for DNA sampling, Johann simply reached in and plucked out some of Romeo's hair with his hands. Romeo's hairs were particularly valuable, not only because he was an intermediate, but also because he was one of the few bears here whose capture location was known. If all unusually colored bears were genetically distinct, and if they came from one clearly defined geographic area, it could mean a new subspecies. If not, they were probably color phases that cropped up throughout Southeast Asia's moon bear populations. That would still be an important discovery, but Don Ruthie would have to wait for a new animal. Romeo, we had learned, had come from the Thai side of the Thai-Cambodia border, just north of the Cardamom Ranges. The story was that Thai police heard a shot, probably his mother being killed, and followed the sound to arrest a Cambodian poacher with the cub in his possession. Romeo had been about 3 months old when he arrived at Banglamong in October 1998. He had first lived in a different wildlife breeding center in central Thailand. By the time he came to Banglamong, he'd become quite aggressive. In fact, we learned, he had taken off part of a British veterinarian's lip with his claws. "That vet was just plain stupid," said Gary Van Zylen in Romeo's defense. 40 stitches later, we figured out we never should have let him volunteer. The trim 38-year-old director of the Thai Society for the Conservation of Wild Animals, Gary Van Zylen, an Australian with a close-cropped mustache and lively green eyes beneath arched eyebrows, did not appreciate stupidity. Nor was he fond of ignorance, inefficiency, or incompetence. But he had numerous stories of his encounters with the same, even from well-meaning Western donors. One donor was upset that the animals' dishes looked unclean at one of our facilities, he told us, so they had an automatic dishwasher sent from Sweden. But guess what we don't have? Running water. He often pulled faces, mimicking the slack-jawed response of a slow-witted person, usually an idiotic official, hanging his head like one of those head-bobbing dashboard toys. One wondered how he had survived so long working alongside the numbing bureaucracy of a third-world government agency. He was alarmingly forthright. Hours after we had met him, which was only that morning, we mentioned to him the name of a mutual acquaintance. "She's a horrible, fat, ugly, screaming old crazy woman," he said. She could have been my beloved auntie, for all he knew. Gary Van Zylen was smart and tough and fit. He runs 3 hours a day, as sharp-witted as he was sharp-tongued. He had a sort of hyper-alertness to him, and he both listened and spoke with great intensity, his green eyes darting and dancing. He knew what he was talking about, too. Often, in his sharp-edged Australian accent, he would rattle off figures: the number of national parks in Thailand, 60, the date of the country's Wildlife Protection Act, 1992, the percentage of an acre that constitutes the Thai unit of land measurement, the rai, 0.395, and I would write these down. When I got back to the States and could check, I found each time he was right on the money. And he was very kind to us. He had generously picked us up that morning from our hotel in Jomtien Beach. We were staying, to our delight, at the astonishingly cheap Mermaid's Beach Resort Hotel, whose bright blue swimming pool and sumptuous breakfast buffet were favored by huge pink Germans and Swedes. Jomtien Beach is a more wholesome suburb of Pattaya, a seaside resort first developed for American GIs during the Vietnam War, now renowned less for its beach, littered and polluted, than for its lively sex trade. "Beautiful, educated ladies, handsome gentlemen, and pretty ladyboy," promised one ad in a tourist flyer. Jomtien Beach offers some of these services, as we noticed from the goings-on at the neighboring Dodo Beer Bar and the Poupe Beer Bar. But mainly the town is an enchanting, if incongruous, picture of what the East thinks the West wants. Most store signs are in English, from the suitably obsequious "Yes, Boss" Custom Tailors to the reassuringly tame "Slow Bunny" horse-riding training center, to the ring of antiquity at Ancient Coffee. Several storefronts combine services for Westerners on the go, like the restaurant sauna, presumably not air-conditioned, and the shower toilet laundry, suggesting a thrifty, if unhygienic, water recycling effort. Restaurant menus offer items geared to Western taste, such as grilled chicken species crumbed and fried godden, super serene pepperoni ham ground beef pork, and, as a nod to American cuisine, fried spaghetti and American fried rice in tomato sauce. Yet for all its Western influence, Jomtien Beach is still possessed of graces unquestionably Thai. At the cafes, beautiful young women with tiny, delicate hands set down each teacup and spoon soundlessly and with great tenderness, as if to make any noise or sudden movement might shatter the customer's Buddha-like meditation. And at the edge of each shopping center, outside each gas station, beside every restaurant, hotel, and internet cafe, there is a spirit house. In Thailand, as in Cambodia, spirits are everywhere. The old animist beliefs coexist graciously alongside Buddhism. There are river spirits and mountain spirits, spirits of deceased people, spirits of caves and of rocks. I'd even read of a Hmong village in northern Thailand where there's a spirit who presides over the cooking of tofu. If the spirit is not honored, the tofu won't set properly. Cooks create a sort of doll made from soybean paste with two red chilies sticking out from the top, and with this, they persuade the spirit to help them. The spirit houses outside most urban buildings are erected to house the spirits of the place. The spirit who might have inhabited the tree that was cut down to make room for the store, or the spirit who inhabited the soil now paved for the parking lot. A large complex, such as a shopping center or hotel, necessitates a particularly spacious and attractive spirit house, so the spirits will voluntarily move there rather than haunt the new structure built for humans. The spirit house outside our hotel was exceptionally well appointed. Flanked by two tiers of flower boxes, a herd of carved teak and stone elephants massed outside the house proper, along with crowds of horses, cows, and human servants for its spirit occupants. The whole structure was piled daily with offerings of fresh flowers, fruits, sweets, and incense. To some, this ancient practice thriving in a busy modern city might seem odd, but to me, it seemed to reflect a rather sophisticated environmental ethic. To be sure, of late, the Thai have been no better stewards of their environment than Americans. Bangkok remains one of the major markets for illegal wildlife trade. Since the turn of the century, loggers have destroyed more than 60% of Thailand's natural forests. Illegal logging was until recently so flagrant that in 1988, the director of the Forest Department himself was arrested for his illegal timber deals. The next year, so many trees had been cut that a flood that normally would have caused little damage resulted in landslides that killed hundreds of people in southern Thailand. But the spirit houses remind the Thai daily of truths Americans have made a national credo of forgetting. That resources are finite. That space is finite. And that in our hunger for more houses, more hotels, more shops, more gas stations, we continually disrupt and displace other beings. Beings perhaps as varied and complex and needful as we are. Thailand's Buddhist heritage, too, was immediately evident to us at Jomtien Beach as soon as we saw all the dogs. Each block had a stray dog or two, sometimes three or five or ten, roaming free on various canine errands. Unlike many African and South American countries, where people stone or hit dogs for no reason, or Cambodia, where people eat them, or America, where strays are rounded up and euthanized, the Thai don't persecute stray dogs. A tenet of Buddhist teaching is compassion for animals. I'm often lost in cities because I don't seem to take in landmarks like buildings. But in Jomtien Beach, I was often able to navigate by recognizing which dogs held territories on which streets. Getting to Bangalamung, though, was another matter. Even though the center was only 10 kilometers away, it's located on unmarked roads amidst a 950-acre forested sanctuary. Without Gary Van Zylen, we would never have found it. Shortly after we passed the edge of town, we saw the tall white spire of the central pagoda of Wat Yang Sang Wararam, mercifully called Wat Yan for short. Reportedly the most spacious of Thailand's more than 30,000 Buddhist temple complexes, its construction began in 1979 to honor the current and most beloved monarch, His Majesty King Bhumibol Adulyadej. Wat Yan is a country monastery whose buildings spread over 118 acres. More important to our host, it is the source of most of Bangalamung's dogs. People dump unwanted dogs and puppies at the temple, the Australian explained. Although the notion of so many homeless dogs distressed us, at least, we offered, this was better than killing a healthy animal, as is too often done in our culture. There is no euthanization here, our host told us. It's not against the law per se, at least no one knows it to be, but, well, it's like stepping on money. You're in pretty hot water if you do it. To pin a flying bill with the toe of the shoe or to tap a rolling coin beneath the foot is considered a grave offense in Thailand. All coins and bills are emblazoned with the image of the king, and to place the foot, the lowliest part of the body, atop his image is considered an insult to his majesty and to all of his subjects. The Thai prescription against euthanasia sometimes conflicts with Western notions of humane treatment. Once, when the monks brought in a dying stray covered with bleeding tumors, one of Gary's vets put it out of its misery. Word of the forbidden act spread through the monastery. Some of the younger monks approved, but most of the elders were deeply upset. The rift took weeks to mend. This was so important to us, to establish a strong relationship with the people around us, Gary said. That's why we got heavily involved with dogs, and our vets look after the odd buffalo or goat for free. They also minister to the health of local elephants. As Gary drove us out of town, we noted no elephant signs along the road, a drawing of a pachyderm with a slashed red circle like a no-smoking sign on an airplane. Elephants were no longer allowed on Pattaya's congested streets, but half a dozen thatched-roof elephant camps still dot the countryside within view of skyscraping hotels. Elephants and their mahouts, formerly employed in the logging industry that Thailand officially outlawed in 1988, now earn their living giving rides to tourists. Almost none of the mahouts can afford to pay for veterinary care. The work of Gary's organization, we learned, was not confined to the Pattaya area. In northern Thailand, TSCWA had funded, designed, and built an enclosure for 8 confiscated moon bears and offered veterinary care for rescued monkeys and gibbons at Am Koi Wildlife Breeding Center. Further north, in Mahang Song's Surin National Park, the organization had constructed a large electric-fenced enclosure for 8 moon bears formerly confined to tiny cages. And at Krabat Khu Wildlife Breeding Center, it had stationed 4 veterinarians and 2 wild animal keepers to care for its more than 400 rescued primates and 20 bears. All this work is done with volunteer labor. Gary amasses volunteers from Thailand, Canada, New Zealand, the Netherlands, Sweden, the United Kingdom, Australia, Germany, and the United States. Each volunteer comes for a minimum 3-month stay and pays for the round-trip airfare to Bangkok as well as for all food and toiletry items. We were deeply impressed with the volunteer's commitment and with Gary's. You must have a deep and abiding love of animals, I said to him admiringly. No, he answered to my surprise, not particularly. How could that be? Surely you must have had a beloved dog when you were growing up or something, I said. No, not really. His mother was wild for Alsatians, and growing up in the suburbs of Sydney, his family had owned a Labrador Retriever. But it was a dog, he said. Like, catch the ball. Come on. I was flummoxed. So what was your background? He'd been trained as a construction engineer, which is why he was so good at building escape-proof outdoor enclosures for the animals. That this is no easy feat is often the reason the animals are confined to tiny cages. We'd heard of one outdoor enclosure, one Gary had not built or supervised, that had to be closed the first day it opened because a moon bear had immediately escaped from it. The fact that this particular moon bear was a cripple with only 3 legs made the engineering failure even more ignominious. But at the age of 28, Gary had given up on building professionally and had come to Thailand. He was actually on his way to London, but stopped off to help a Thai girl with her baggage. At check-in at the Sydney airport, he'd claimed that her overweight luggage was his own to save her the charges. So when the flight stopped in Bangkok, he stopped off to visit her. He liked Bangkok. After earning a journalism certificate at the London School of Journalism in a record 3 weeks, he chose Bangkok as his base. He began covering corporate issues in the music industry for English-language newspapers. That, I pointed out, did not begin to explain how he came to work with animals. Well, meanwhile, he said, two friends, in an effort to improve conditions for a number of gibbons rescued from the wildlife trade, asked him to design and build some cages for the rescued apes. Out of their efforts, the three inaugurated a new wildlife charity, the Thai Society for the Conservation of Wild Animals. But while the new organization was being set up, a legal process that took over a year, one of the friends, a Scottish zookeeper, left to work in Kenya. The other went home to America. Running the new society, which he founded with the help of two other friends who were Thai, fell to him. As Gary put it, I ended up with the organization by default. That still didn't seem to explain why, a decade later, he was still working for free, in appalling heat, and often confounded by infamous bureaucracy, to run a Thai fund for animals. Gary Van Zylen arched one eyebrow and looked at me from beneath the bill of his baseball cap, as if he thought, as he might put it, I had lost the plot. It was a job that needed to be done. And then he pointedly changed the subject. Though Gary himself was an enigma, his organization was an open book, quite literally. At the end of the day, we asked him if it were possible to find more information on where his bears were originally captured. He offered us complete access to his records. Over the years, volunteers have compiled voluminous data on each bear, and this is kept in three large loose-leaf binders stored among the bookshelves in the little cinder block house where the volunteers stay, next to the dog compound. Each bear is represented by a photograph as well as a verbal description, and further identified by a microchip implanted just under the skin, whose number is duly recorded. The number can be read, at close range, requiring the bear be sedated, with a handheld device like those at American supermarket checkout counters. The written records, we found, were mostly concerned with each bear's medical history. Volunteers noted the date and details of each health check and the bear's dental condition. Skin and gut parasites were noted and treated. Vaccines were recorded, complete with dates and batch numbers. There was a space on each form to note behavior. When he first arrived at Bangalmong in 1998, Stripe, the yellow-eyed bear who had peered into Gary's window, was so shy, a volunteer wrote, that he, quote, would rather sleep outdoors in the pouring rain than try to sneak inside the dens with the other bears. But we were disappointed to find almost no data on where most of the bears had been captured. Perhaps no one ever knew. Or perhaps, as information with little bearing on the animal's health or welfare, it had been deemed superfluous. Their focus was obviously not on genetic variation, noted Gary. There was not even a spot for recording this data on the forms. However, we noted a number of animals described as having lighter coats or portions thereof. To these we paid particular attention. Besides Lewis, Stripe, and Romeo, two bears stood out. Harem, the bear rescued by the good ladies of the massage parlor, had a blondish face. Another female, Babe, had a raccoon effect around the eyes, browned eye rings set against darker fur. There was no information on where either came from. A few others were listed as having minor coat variations, light speckles on the forehead, a pale streak between the eyes, and we noted these bears and their microchip numbers. But most surprising was what someone, the entries were unsigned, had written in the behavior profiles of Stripe, Lewis, and Harem. Lao subspecies markings, and possibly Lao subspecies. There is no Lao subspecies, Gary said. Of this there was no doubt. Gary had scoured the records. Some 14 species or subspecies of the moon bear have been named or proposed, and he knew all of them. The brownish-furred moon bears from southern Pakistan were designated Ursus tibetanus gedrosianus. Some very small moon bears of Japan were named Japonicus. The large ones living in Siberia and Manchuria, Eusuricus. But there were no subspecies of moon bears anywhere in Southeast Asia. There was almost nothing published in the scientific literature on bears from Laos. Further, there was no reason to think that Stripe, Lewis, or Harem had come from Laos, as there was no information on their profiles about their origins. We were nonetheless intrigued. Of course, the idea of a lighter race of moon bears centered in Laos may have merely been the wild speculation of an untrained Western volunteer. But possibly, this entry reflected genuine local knowledge that the mystery volunteer had somehow picked up. After all, local people had known for many years about the Sao La, the Vietnamese warty hog, and the other new species that scientists only discovered in the 1990s. No scientist had ever reported golden or light-haired moon bears, but perhaps they were already well known to the Laotians who live among them. And if local people distinguished these bears from the common black moon bears, perhaps the difference was sufficient for them to constitute a new species after all. Although there were no golden bears at Banglamong, we had heard of another place in Thailand that reportedly had one, a zoo 150 kilometers north of Bangkok in the town of Lop Buri. Still sore from the motorcycle ride, Gary had rented an air-conditioned Mercedes and a driver to take us there. But we faced an awkward dilemma. We'd written to the zoo director, whose name we'd obtained from a friend, but received no response, probably because he could not read English and we couldn't write in Thai. Though Lop Buri was once a capital, from there the Khmers had administered to their empire's Thai population from the 9th through 13th centuries. Today, its main attraction is an ancient temple overrun with 700 pink-faced, long-tailed monkeys known as rhesus macaques. The monkeys are considered sacred in the town, and the people, crediting them for bringing happiness and prosperity, freely allow the macaques to steal belongings, ransack shops, tease schoolchildren, assault temple worshippers, and stop traffic. The place receives few foreign visitors. Almost none of its citizens speak English. We were worried about the kind of welcome we would receive when two farangs showed up and inexplicably began to pull hair out of the zoo animals. "No worries," exclaimed our Australian host. He knew the facility. It was run, he told us, by the Thai military and was one of the oldest zoos in the country. In fact, one of his current volunteers had previously worked there. He generously offered us to free her from her duties at Banglamong so she could accompany us there. "You can't imagine how many monkeys escaped during the month I was there just because someone left the door open," said Corina Soutel, the 24-year-old veterinary nurse whom Gary deposited at our hotel the next morning. "There's not one trained zoo worker, just soldiers going into tiger cages with nothing but a broom." When she'd first appeared at Lop Buri, Corina had caused quite a stir. A rail-thin woman with beautiful blue eyes and large, gentle, slow-moving hands, Corina sported a silver stud in her lower lip, another just like it in her left nostril, a third shaped like a kangaroo in her right nostril, and buzz-cut blonde hair framing ears sequined with pierced earrings. She also had three tattoos and was considering a fourth, provided she could find an artist to create a credible binturong. When she'd come to Banglamong, Gary Van Zylen had eventually banned her from visiting Wat Yan because the monks would drop everything to stare at her. She'd come to Lop Buri as part of a volunteer program to help train the soldiers in the task of caring for their charges and to find ways to make the animals' lives more interesting inside their sometimes tiny cages. Corina lives for opportunities like these. Trained just outside Hamburg as a veterinary nurse, she'd spent a year working for an animal clinic before volunteering on an 11-week sea turtle conservation project in Greece. She was hooked, not just on the travel, she explained, but on using her skills to do more than give Fifi her annual rabies shot. As a volunteer on projects like these, she could help animals who were in desperate need. Returning to Germany, she'd worked at a bakery and then 2 months at a McDonald's, the ultimate sacrifice for her, a strict vegan, to earn the money to go back to Greece to volunteer again during the summer of 1997. Since then, she had spent all her winters working at a printing office close enough to home that she could ride her bike there, working nights, weekends, and overtime, just to earn the money to work as a volunteer at jobs that desperately needed doing, but for which no one will pay. Lop Buri Zoo, she explained, did not begin as a zoo, but as a bin to dump animals. When people no longer wanted their pet bear or found an orphaned monkey, they brought it to the local authorities. In this case, this was the military. Locals still bring unwanted animals here. Just during the month Corina worked at Lop Buri, the zoo acquired an unwanted pet oriental small-clawed otter, and took in two crab-eating macaques, whose cage bore an English label reading crap-eating macaque, as well as a cast-off moon bear. The soldiers at this special warfare center do their best as zookeepers, but this is a zoo unlike any Gary or I had seen before. When we first arrived, the place seemed much like an American zoo of perhaps 40 years ago. Cartoonish sculptures of animals adorn the paths to the exhibits. Treats to hand-feed the animals are sold at booths, and people can, and do, easily pass their hands through the bars of all the cages to touch the animals, including the tigers. But the two Indochinese tigers, we quickly noticed, weren't the only species in their exhibit. Along with the two huge adult cats lived a family of dogs, 5 black and 1 yellow, prey items who, to our amazement, the tigers were not eating. The tigers were brother and sister orphans, Karina explained. Both were suckled by the mother dog along with her own litter, and today they all lived together peacefully as a family. Dogs, in fact, roamed all over the zoo. While working elephants merged with motorcycle and auto traffic on the highway outside its gates, dogs lived inside the zoo. They waited by the food concessions. They guarded the exhibits. Some of them had visible mange. They entered the exotic animals' cages with impunity, eating their food, defecating in the enclosures, sometimes harassing the inmates. Although the strays were known to spread disease, one of the zoo's 4 binturongs, Karina told us, had recently died of canine distemper, nothing was done to dissuade them. Dogs followed us everywhere from the moment we entered the zoo. Each seemed to have staked out a territory and would bark at you when you entered it, accompany you as you walked through it, and then, at some boundary known only to them, pass your company on, like a baton, to the next dog down the line. Stray cats were fewer, but they also turned up in strange places. One enclosure held a cassowary, a tall, flightless, vicious bush bird native to Australia and New Guinea, and a number of large, handsome, greenish monitor lizards. These meat-eating lizards are second only to Komodo dragons in size and ferocity. Fleet and strong-jawed, they can take down a deer and slash its throat. To our dismay, we saw a small tabby kitten inside their enclosure. Had some cruel tourist tossed it in over the moat where the predatory lizards now swam? One of the reptiles emerged from the water and, flicking its long, black, forked tongue, headed directly toward the kitten. We began to shout to try to warn her, but the kitten ignored us. When the 4-foot lizard finally reached her, we braced for the worst. She simply rubbed her lips and chin against its scaly flesh, like a house cat greeting her owners come home for work at the end of the day. The bear enclosure was heralded by a large billboard announcing in English that this was Mary's Bear Home. The exhibit, which besides the indoor cages includes an outdoor yard with 2 bathing pools and plenty of climbing trees, was donated by Mary Hutton, we read, an Australian with her own organization, Free the Bears Fund. 9 bears lived here, 7 moon bears and 2 sun bears. From one of the sun bears arose the sound of a swarm of bees. Although he seemed to be nearly adult, he was sucking his paw, emitting the same strange, almost mechanical noise that baby bears make when suckling from their mothers. At close range, it sounds like a cross between the nickering of a goat and the hum of a sump pump. I had heard this before. Ben's orphan cubs made it when they sucked on his ears, and they continued to do so even when they were more than a year old. Bear cubs taken too early from their mother's breast sucked their paws for comfort like a child sucks its thumb. That was surely the case with the bears here. All of them, we read, were rescued from the illegal wildlife trade. One of the moon bears had only 3 feet. Karina told us he was named Stumpy, and that he had been rescued from a poacher who was caught in the act of amputating his left rear paw for soup. Then I saw at a glance there was a lion living in the bear exhibit. A tawny, fat, male lion with a huge, fluffy, light brown mane was placidly chewing on what looked like a bit of bok choy held between its giant paws, in among the big black ursines in the cages. This was odd for a lion, I thought. And then I saw, surrounded by the lion's mane, the face of a bear. "This is the largest, blondest bear we've ever seen," said Gary. She was the first blonde adult we had seen, proof that the blonde color was not merely a growth phase. Another large moon bear in the enclosure looked like a more dramatic version of Stripe, a big, pale-faced, eye-ringed male with a head, forelegs, and mane even darker than Stripe's, but a much lighter back. But the most important data was still lacking. We needed to know where these bears came from, and if that could be determined, to pull some hairs. This, with Karina's kind help, we arranged the next day. One of the keepers she knew, a young soldier she called Tom, spoke some English. Tom agreed to ask Lieutenant Colonel Wirat Pupunjai, the zoo's director, about the bear's origins, and to act as our translator as we interviewed him. Tom also agreed to help us pull hairs. It proved remarkably easy. The bear's indoor enclosure was, we were thrilled to learn, equipped with what is known in the zoo trade as a squeeze or crush cage. A portion of the cage is fitted with three walls that can be moved from the outside to confine the animal in a tight space for administering shots and other treatments without tranquilizing the animal. Most of the bears were easily persuaded to enter the cage for a food reward. With no danger to either us or the bears, we plucked to our heart's content. As well as the blonde bear, Bertha, and the intermediate, Dave, we harvested the black bears, too. "Why not?" suggested Gary. Though we didn't really need their hairs, they could come in handy, especially if something happened to the other black bear hairs we were using for comparison with the gold ones. So into the squeeze cage and into our test tube went, respectively, each bear and its DNA. The enormous Daisy, who'd been held in a small cage for so long that when she did venture outside, she stayed near the door. The towering male Linz, whom Tom had to coax into the crush cage after the huge bear stood up and snarled spectacularly at him by brandishing a metal bar. The smaller Luke, still impressive with a big mane. And the smallest moon bear, Baby, with a bald patch on his side that Tom told us was produced when his previous owner dropped on him a pot of scalding water. Baby cried in fear in the squeeze cage. I plucked him as quickly as I could. We took hairs from all the moon bears except Stumpy. We figured he'd been through enough already. By the time we appeared at the director's octagonal fan-cooled office for our interview, Colonel Wirat, a dapper, cheerful man of 52, had scoured the zoo's records. He had great news. While there was no information on any of the black bears but Stumpy, who had been rescued in Nakhon Sawan province, he knew where both Bertha and Dave had been captured. Bertha, who was now quite elderly, had been found as a cub on the slopes of a highland bamboo forest while farmers were clearing it by burning. "The people living in the mountain catch lots of bears," Tom translated, "sometimes for food. But sometimes the bears are special, and this family, they were eager to have it. Someone wanted to buy it, but the family wanted to keep it because she is pretty." The same family, some years later, had similarly captured Dave as a cub. Both bears, Colonel Wirat assured us, had come from the same place, in the Long Pabong Mountains, on the Thai side of the border with northern Laos, near a village the colonel identified as Bong Pong Kea. Gary hauled out one of his maps and began to plot the locations of all the known golden and light-colored bears we had found. Remarkably, from Sun Hien's bears in southwestern Cambodia to Romeo's rescue site in Thailand to Bertha and Dave's original home at the edge of Laos to Gary's first bear in Yunnan, all the points strung out in an arc that ran right through northern Laos. We would return to America in a few days, but we had already begun to plan our next expedition.